The topic that we're going to deal with today is the opposite of a topic that's frequently spoken about in our community. And I'm consciously speaking about it with some frequency because we confront a little bit of a dilemma, which is when we incessantly speak about the need not to gossip and not to recite Lashon Hara and to ignore the rumors that run around us, we miss half the conversation in Hilchos Lashon Hara. And by missing half the conversation, we incompletely fulfill the direction of Halacha here in many very significant and important ways. Hilchos Lashon Hara, speaking in a broad sense, is a balance of two values. And if you only talk about one of these two values, you misunderstand what's going on. The first value, and the value that we teach our children all the time, incessantly, is don't gossip. And that you shouldn't repeat information that you hear, and you shouldn't go about spreading rumors, all of which is wonderful and true. And a good message to tell children, and a particularly important message in a society that's incessantly gossip-oriented. But there's a second side of Hilchos Lashon Hara that's equally important to emphasize and that needs to be said over and over again as well, which is when you're aware of a piece of information that's relevant to share with another person to prevent harm to an innocent person, you must share it. And you can't say to yourself, oh my gosh, this is Lashon Hara. On the contrary, this is not at all Lashon Hara. This is frequently a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'echa. When you hear two people conspiring to go kill somebody, and you overhear them, and you say to yourself, oh, I shouldn't repeat this. After all, this is gossip. That would be an egregious misbalance of what the halacha is. Halacha requires, just like you not repeat information randomly to people just for the sake of rumor mongering and gossiping, when you're aware of a piece of information that's relevant to another and it meets certain criteria that we're going to talk about today, halacha mandates that you repeat it. Now, to some extent, this analysis is easy if you imagine that all the facts are always clear all the time. Because it goes without saying, or it's commonsensical, that when I hear two very bad people who I know are intending to act conspire to kill somebody, that I have to tell them. That's literally a fulfillment of Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'echa through and through. But the real world is, of course, made up of much more complicated, nuanced situations where the real problem is that the listener hears a piece of information, and you know what? He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know, is the information true? He doesn't know if the people who he heard say it are kidding. Life is more complex because we don't all wear T-shirts which either contain a Superman sign indicating you're a good person or a T-shirt which says, I'm a very, very, very bad person, and you can tell they're very bad. And we have an even bigger problem. Sometimes the bad guys wear Superman T-shirts to make life a little bit more complicated. And so what you have is an ongoing halachic discourse about how to figure out how to handle nefarious pieces of information. And the Gemara itself recounts it, and the Gemara itself recounts it in the context of Gedaliah ben Achikam, who we fast for today. And it's worth reviewing this simple piece of Gemara in front of us to understand the Talmudic criticism of Gedaliah. Now, Gedaliah ben Achikam was a good man who was working very hard to save the Jewish people after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, but he was a little bit naive, the Gemara recounts to us. If you turn to source number one, on what's numbered is page 3, and you go down 7 lines. So the 7th line, 3 words from the end. So the Gemara recounts to us the story. Yochanan ben Karach approached Gedaliah ben Achikam, and you know what he said to him? There are bad people out there who don't agree with your policies, and do you know what they're going to do to you? They're going to kill you because they really don't like what you're going to do. You're going to be the victim of a political assassination. And the Gemara says at the end of the seventh line, Ela mitov shahal shahayulon lachush ma'etzat Yochanan ben Korach v'lochash, now in the eighth line, ma'alakas yilohargan Gedalia ben Achikam ignored Yochanan ben Korach's assertion that they're going to kill you. You know what Gedalia ben Achikam said? I can't believe you when you tell me that people are going to kill me. You know why? It's Lashon Hara. And so I should ignore this advice and conduct myself as if there is no threat. It turns out that there was a big threat and they did kill him. And the Gemara recounts that Gedalia ben Achikam is blamed a little bit because even though he shouldn't have absolutely, totally, and unquestionably believed this information, you know what he should have done? Nechush. He should have said, maybe this information is correct. And by saying, maybe this information is correct, you know what he would have done? In modern terms, he would have said, beefed up his security. He would have walked around with a larger contingent of bodyguards and taken greater precautions to prevent people from killing him. He should have said, not, I can't believe this information, it is Lashon Hara. He should have said, I can't believe this information as 100% true, but you know what I nonetheless should do? I should say, maybe this information is true. Since maybe this information is true, you know what I should do? I should conduct myself as if there's a threat to my life and be precautious. Wear a bulletproof vest, walk around with bodyguards, not go touring Times Square in public, take other reasonable precautions as advised to me by my security team. And Gedalia ben Achikam bears a blame for this, for the outcome here, because he was overzealous in Hilchos Lashon Hara and underzealous in Lo Tamod al Dam Re'echa. In this case, the blood that flowed was sadly enough his. But it's important to understand the Talmudic criticism of Gedalia ben Achikam. The Talmudic criticism of Gedalia ben Achikam resonates with me. It says Gedalia ben Achikam was a good man. And because he was a good man, whenever he heard a vile rumor, he said, oh, I can't believe this vile rumor, because this vile rumor will reflect poorly on some people. I must instead ignore this rumor. But the Gemara's point is that it's foolish and inappropriate to ignore certain kinds of rumors, even though you can't categorically believe them. Nonetheless, you can't any more categorically disbelieve them than you should categorically believe them. And what are you supposed to do when you hear these rumors? Consider them. Recognize the possibility that there is a dark side in people and act appropriately. And the Gemara continues with the next story on line 10. Hanu b'nei Galili, d'nafik Eliyahu kol d'kitul nashi. There were these Galileans who the word had spread that they had killed somebody. Also a kaimei the Rebbe Tarfon, and they came in front of Rebbe Tarfon. Amru hu l'tmarinanmar. You should hide us. They said to Rabbi Tarfon, you know what? We need help. The government is running after us to catch us and kill us. You know what we need you to do? Help us escape. Because if they catch us, bad things will come to us. So the Gemara says, Amru hu hechi na'avad, I lot min ufidu chazi ufaisvot ra'ili. So he says as follows, I can't hide you and I can't not hide you. Why? So the Gemara says, Achagav de Kibli lo mi bai, Mechus lay mi bai. Rabbi Tarfon accepted the Talmudic statement. He said, look, I don't know if you killed anybody or not. There's a rumor out that you killed somebody. So you know what I'm supposed to do? I'm supposed to acknowledge the truth. What's the truth that Rabbi Tarfon has? I don't know if the gossip about you is true or false. So you know what I can't do? I can't operate under the assumption that it's true, because that would be very not fair to you. But simultaneously, I can't operate under the assumption that it's false, because if I operate under the assumption that it's false, you know what? I'll be assisting you and you're wrong. As Rashi so directly put it, Rashi says, look, Rabbi Tarfon's in a dilemma. These guys came to him and said, we're on the land from the government. The government accuses me of us of killing somebody. What do we say, by the way? What do all people accused of a crime say?
Innocent.
I'm innocent. They don't always say innocent people. They say, I'm innocent. I didn't do it. It was a setup. I'm totally and completely innocent. On the other hand, Rabbi Tarfon says, what? I don't know. And here's my dilemma, Rashi says. If I help you escape, you know what? I myself am sinning. How come? Because it's not good to let people, to help people escape from a murder. If in fact you really did kill somebody, then assisting you in hiding and running away from the government who's trying to catch you, that doesn't sound like a good idea. On the other hand, if you're innocent and you're on the lam from a false accusation, then allowing you to escape is also a good thing. So Rabbi Tarfon says, I don't know what to do. I'm sorry? No, two unrelated stories, separated by 500 years. And they're two actually unrelated stories. But the Gemara's point here is to emphasize to us the two sides of rumor mongering, which is, you as a person who hears rumors, you're supposed to conduct yourself not like the Dalia Benefica and say, I can't believe any rumor that I hear. You're supposed to conduct yourself like Rabbi Tarfon, which is when you hear something, you're supposed to say to yourself, you know, I don't know if this rumor is true or false. I'm supposed to say maybe this rumor is true, and maybe this rumor is false, and I'm supposed to conduct myself in a modicum of protection against both views. Now, the Tosfos HaRosh famously stopped to argue on Rashi. The Tosfos HaRosh says, source number 3, Peirush Rashi Risheva HaRakta, maybe he killed somebody, V'asur Lahatzil Etchem, V'tema, and the Rosh says, I'm surprised by this, V'tema Lomar Kain, She'im Yatsa Kol Al-Adam Shechata, V'shvil Ze'asur Lahatzil Nafsho, the Rosh says, how is it possible that just because there's a rumor that you killed, that I should be prevented from saving your life? Rather, the Rosh says, it's more intuitive to say that I should ignore the rumor and save the life in front of you. And the Rosh gives another answer which has different ramifications for a different topic, but the Rosh seems to be more inclined to believe that at least when lives are at stake, you're not allowed to believe rumors, and you're supposed to conduct yourself as if the information that you hear is absolutely, totally false. What you have here is a classical dilemma that the Poskim like to point out, which is, when you hear information, you're just not sure how to classify it. If we knew immediately, if we could look at every single rumor and immediately determine if this rumor is true or false, we would have no problem, because we would then believe the true rumors and we would disbelieve the false rumors, and life would be exquisitely simple. But in the real world where we actually live in, we hear pieces of information and you know what? We really don't know what to do with them. If we knew this information was true, we would conduct ourselves in a certain way. If, on the other hand, we knew this information was false, we would conduct ourselves in a totally different way, and we're not sure what to do. Now, the Mishnah Berurah in the Chafetz Chaim, on page 5, Im Echad Roa Shechavera Rotsa Lishateifa Eze Davar Im Echad V'hu Mishar Shebivada Yisev Lo Al Yidei Zeh Inyan Ra. The Chafetz Chaim says, if I see a person
who's coming to do an evil thing, and I know for certain that the evil thing is what he plans to do, then I should tell him. What would you read into this Chavos Chaim? What's the crucial operative word?
Certainty.
Certainty. The Chavos Chaim joins the group of Rishonim and Achronim, who says, the only time I can listen to gossip is when I've done enough investigation that I'm 100% certain that the information under discussion is true. If I'm not sure the information under discussion is true or false, what am I supposed to do?
Ignore it.
That's 100% correct. Now, Reb Chaim Ozer Grzinski, in one of his tshuvot, and also in notes that he published on the Chavos Chaim, notes that he doesn't think that this approach is correct. He says as follows: there's no reason to operate under the assumption of the word vadai. I would translate the word vadai as certain. Does somebody want to tell me what certain means in the probabilistic sense? I would say vadai means 100%. Vadai means certain. Reb Chaim Ozer says he doesn't understand why the Mishnah of the Chavos Chaim puts in the word vadai. He says as follows: you're continuously in a balance between two prohibitions. One prohibition is a prohibition to recount Lashon Hara. And the other prohibition is the prohibition of lo ta'amod al dam ra'acha, do not stand by while your neighbor's blood is shed. And you have to continuously engage in a balance between these two possible prohibitions. And he understands that what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to determine which piece of information is what? More likely true. Now, there's a huge gap in the real world between the Chafetz Chaim's explanation of the halacha and Reb Chaim Ozer's explanation of the halacha. Reb Chaim Ozer seems to say that when I'm 51% certain, now 51% certain means what? It means I'm wrong 49 out of 100 times. That meaning, Reb Chaim Ozer's point goes as follows: when I think this gossip is more likely true than false, I'm supposed to take this gossip and relay it to a person who can use it to avoid harm. I still, of course, can't repeat it to everybody, because it's not necessary to repeat it to everybody. But in a situation in which there's a target, and I assess all the information in front of me, and I determine that it's likely that the information I have in front of me is true. Not certain, not 100% guaranteed to be correct, but just more likely than not to be correct. I'm supposed to take this information to the person and say, I don't know the truth, but I heard this, and it sounds plausible, because, and thus you should act on it. And indeed, one of the strong proofs that Reb Chaim Ozer gives is our story of Gedaliah ben Achikam. He says as follows: Gedaliah ben Achikam could not have been an idiot. They came to him with information that somebody was trying to kill him. If it had been vadai, certain that they were trying to kill him, you know what Gedaliah ben Achikam would have done? He certainly would have acted on him. Who would be so foolish as to not to? Rather, he says, Gedaliah ben Achikam looked at this information and said, well, it's only likely to be true. I shouldn't act on information that's only likely to be true when I'm not certain that it's true. And yet, the Chaim Ozer points out he was criticized for this. Please, Kim.
At what point does the concept of Shema Tovah come into play?
So now we'll add another point. It sits Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, who died just a few years ago, wants to draw another distinction. He wants to distinguish between defensive and offensive use of Lashon Hara. What does he mean by that? He says as follows. Sometimes you encounter a piece of information, and if the information is false, no harm comes from you defending yourself from it. And if the information is true, you can take defensive steps to make it irrelevant. Let me give you a practical example. I hear somebody's trying to kill me. So I wake up every morning, I put my tits on, and after I put my tits on, you know what I put on? My bulletproof vest. And then I put my shirt on. Now the Tzitz Eliezer says, it's true, the only reason why I'm wearing my bulletproof vest is because I heard a rumor. On the other hand, if the rumor turns out to be false, then what? No harm. If I walk around with a bulletproof vest today, nobody shot at me. And no harm came of that. The Tzitz Eliezer thinks that the standard for believing defensive Lashon Hara, where what you're going to do is you're going to take steps to prevent the bad from happening. But if it turns out the rumor is false, nobody is harmed, is at a much lower threshold than taking steps to use Lashon Hara, to use rumors that you heard, in a way that if it turns out the rumors are false, are very harmful to other people. This is part of a very complicated dilemma. I think when you stop and look along with the consensus of the Achronim, the consensus of the Achronim is somewhere around either Chaim Ozer or the Tzitz Eliezer, which is the Achronim say as follows. You don't have to rise all the way to the level of the Mishnah Berurah's Vadai, 100% certainty, before you can take into account gossip that you hear. Instead, a person is supposed to take into account gossip that they hear defensively at a relatively low threshold, and offensively at a higher threshold, but a threshold far below the threshold of 100%. 100% is an exceptionally high threshold. And the postman, in addition, note the difference between where you are recounting the Lashon Hara. There's a difference between testifying in court, for example, which has a very high threshold of truthfulness, and merely putting on a bulletproof vest, or ordering an audit, or otherwise sharing information. So this calculus is itself quite complicated. I wanted to review two shilohs that over the past few years have come into setting the right answer shilohs and use it as a framework for thinking about Lashon Hara. It is Sunday afternoon at 3:30, page one. Page two. I'm sorry, page one is the front cover. It is Sunday afternoon at 3:30. Licensed marriage counselor calls and recounts the following. Marriage counselors have been counseling a couple of three children. They're very difficult marriage. 10 days ago, at the end of the last counseling session, husband, age 42, announced that he was leaving the marriage and seeking divorce. Wife, age 40, begged for him and cajoled him not to leave, and he agreed not to. Sometimes this Saturday or early Sunday morning, husband died in his sleep. Causes unknown. Wife has set funeral for Monday morning. Police have walked door to door in the neighborhood asking if anyone has any reason to suspect any form of foul play, and have gotten no positive response. Under the law in the state marriage counselor is in, a search warrant is needed to compel an autopsy against the wishes of the family. Wife will not give permission for autopsy, citing religious beliefs. Marriage counselor believes that if he tells the police what he knows, that will be enough to generate probable cause for warrant to be issued and an autopsy done. This will delay the funeral a day, and a minimum will also be public knowledge that probable cause was found for an autopsy. Marriage counselor wants to know if you should, must, may, or must not speak to the police. Now, what's a marriage counselor's mind? What thought has crossed marriage counselor's mind? She killed him. Marriage counselor has a thought. She killed him. What evidence does marriage counselor have? None. Zero. Absolutely not a single piece of information. But what does she have? Intimate knowledge of a tumultuous relationship between the two of them, followed by his sob He also has somewhere working in the background that she wrote to send to an autopsy, although it's very hard to know what that really means. Maybe she won't consent to an autopsy because the rabbi said you shouldn't consent to an autopsy. An autopsy, we assume, will verify whether he was killed or not. On the other hand, it's enormous lashon hara here. How come?
There's no
bavai, and not only that, this is an exceptionally damaging rumor. What's the rumor that's going to be generated by the marriage counselors informing the police? That she's a suspect in the murder of her husband. That's a terrible thing to have to live with. Meaning that will do terrible damage to their children, who are already in a terrible situation. Their father died unexpectedly. Well, all of a sudden, they not only have to deal with the fact that their father died unexpectedly, but they have to deal with the fact that their playmates in the school playground, where the most cruel things are said and done, will turn to them and say, "You hear your mommy is suspected of killing your daddy." That's an enormously damaging piece of art. On the other hand, we have to balance this with what? What's on the other side?
Justice.
Justice, not only justice in some abstract sense, but presumably of people who will kill their husbands in anger in these types of situations. That's an awfully relevant piece of information that husband number two might want to know. Meaning, this is a woman who poses a threat. People who kill in this kind of situation, this is frequently not a one-time event. When you look at this, so you look up and you say, wow, this is a very hard child. Literally, what you have here are DNA nefashot in all directions. Not just in the sense that maybe she killed him.
Doesn't make sense. Here's a woman who contested the desire of her husband to leave her. She was leaving him. She begged him to stay.
Right.
Everything would speak to the fact that she doesn't want him gone.
On the other hand, the wife of the marriage counselor said as follows. Maybe he turned to her Saturday night and said, you know, I've thought about it, and I'm out of here. On the other hand,
it's the greatest state of suffering, not what he heard in his office, but beyond.
On the other hand, it's very speculative. You're 100% correct. All we have here is speculation. On the other hand, the marriage counselor says as follows. We can totally and completely eliminate the speculation by doing what?
An autopsy.
Not only that, the marriage counselor says the rumor is already out on the street that maybe she killed him. How come? I'm sorry? The police went door to door saying, does anybody have a reason to suspect foul play? Although they didn't say who committed the foul play. You don't have to be a prophet to figure out who might be a suspect in this situation. This is a very hard one. On the other hand, the false accusation, the swearing out of a search warrant to get probable cause, to delay the funeral against the wishes of the wife, is really an exceptionally damaging piece of information because the police, in essence, have to say they have probable cause to believe the husband was murdered unless they want an autopsy.
Is there any possibility here of another competing value? And that is, if the marriage counsel has an obligation under the law, given the malus agreement?
Yes, in general, marriage counselors don't have this obligation, and there was no such obligation in this state either. Marriage counselors are not what we call a licensed professional in most states, the way, for example, a child psychologist is. People function as marriage counselors with much less professional oversight than, you know, if you opened up a shingle saying you're a child psychologist, you better be a licensed child psychologist, whereas marriage counseling is a much less regulated field without this requirement.
Once the autopsy shows that she did not do anything,
right?
Then that clear, I mean, that undoes.
On the other hand, here's the argument. There's no problem ordering the autopsy. autopsy because there's a mamasha. At the end of the autopsy, one of two results will occur, either of which is wonderful. Either the autopsy will show he was suffocated by a pillow, in which case we really do need to know this piece of information, and that's extremely relevant, or the autopsy will show that he died from whatever he died from, and she had nothing to do with it, in which case this is also good. But that's not 100% true, because let me tell you a reality about our world. Lashon Hara flows far faster and farther than the correction. The Lashon Hara that will follow this woman her whole rest of her life is as follows. In big, huge letters, she was suspected in killing her husband, and in little letters, 12 minutes later, she was clear. So it's not 100% true that the exoneration is this way. Most of us would not like to be accused of a crime and then exonerated. Again, think of many different people who we could imagine who were accused of crimes and then exonerated. Very few of us look up and say, oh, that was not traumatic, since ultimately they were exonerated. Doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that's sort of the sense without saying that there is no autopsy, and it's because of her objection, then we'll have the same headline, and we know that stuff.
Of course! Your response goes as follows. Well, it's true that the autopsy might exonerate her, but without the autopsy, there'll always be a big headline which says, wife was accused of murder and was not exonerated. And was not, on the other hand,
was not the root of her exoneration.
On the other hand, her response, she's not here, but so to speak, if she were to advance a climate, she's made the following calculus. She'd rather live with an unsubstantiated rumor than a police warrant followed by a judge ordered to land her funeral. That's her final stop, please.
You could think of making a hackish and eating of sofa and saying that you made the sofa drink in order to clarify the situation. But the difference is, here, the rumor continues afterwards, and by sofa, if she's innocent, she gets pregnant.
Okay. It's hard to analogize things to sofa. This is a very hard Lashon Hara question. I confess to you, I've thought about this question many times from many different sides without a clear answer as to how to go about answering this question. I see not only the two sides, but the three or four sides to this problem in many different directions.
Another possibility is that the autopsy is inconclusive.
And another possibility is the autopsy is inconclusive. I agree.
I think you have to note here, the Lashon Hara is not that she suspects of murder. Nobody will say that. The only Lashon Hara that is here is that the marriage was bad. Now, that can trigger you and I to think ourselves.
Okay.
There's no Lashon Hara over here that she committed murder. So he then has committed different type of grievous act against this person, but it's not that kind of
question. Okay, on the other hand, the police have already gone door to door asking if anybody suspects foul play. You don't have to be brilliant to figure out who might have done the foul play. My intuition in this case is that only the marriage counselor can really know the answer to this question in the following sense. Only the marriage counselor can close their eyes and say to themselves, given all of my interactions with him and her,
is it shy that she could do it?
Is it likely that she would do it? Did she ever express to him in the course of counseling, he'd be threatened to leave me off guilty? This would be a much easier case if she had turned to him and said, if you ever leave me, I'll kill you. That would make it a much easier case. I'm not sure. That's right. You know, threatening is very complicated. Threatening is only the marriage counselor here really has enough information to look up and answer this child. Because the marriage counselor has a much better picture than the posseh to help us determine whether, in fact, this is a case of a bad marriage followed by a stroke from stress, or this is a bad marriage followed by an asphyxiation from a pillow. Those are two very different possibilities, and it's just uncertain how to handle this. The marriage counselor, the person who spent countless sessions dealing with the marriage between the two of them, probably has a better handle on it
I said to the marriage counselor, if you think that it's more likely than not that she killed him, then you should go to the police. If you're not certain as to what to do beyond that piece of information, I'm not certain what to do either beyond that piece of information. This is a classical hard question. The reason why it's a hard question is not because the halakha is unclear. It's a hard question because the facts are unclear. If we knew for sure that she killed him, then this would be an easy case. If we knew for sure that she didn't kill him, this would also be an easy case. What makes this case uncertain, which by the way I find to be true for most hard Russian hard questions, is that you encounter a piece of information, you look at it, you think about it, you examine it, and you say, you know what this piece of information is? Plausible. Beyond plausible, I don't know what it is. And then you have to follow the Gemara's mantra of mechush mibar. You have to think maybe it's true, but you can't act on the certainty that it's not to be true. And figuring out how to do that is a very hard thing to do. Let's go on to the next case. You're a tax lawyer in a firm and a part-time school rabbi. And due to the slip of the tongue, there's a typo here by me, I'm sorry. By two of your colleagues in a competing firm, one of whom mentioned that Reuven Goldberg has come to your firm as a new client with interest in business, and another of whom asked your advice about a criminal tax matter, saying the firm rarely does this work, but a new client came in with a serious criminal tax matter and is facing indictment. Now, you heard all of this information, and what went off in your mind? What went off in your mind is Reuven Goldberg might have a very serious tax problem and he's facing indictment. Based on what did you do that? You heard piece of information A and piece of information B and you put it together. That, by the way, happens in the law firm business and in any other business all the time. You suspect that Reuven Goldberg might be facing criminal tax charges. Do you know this information?
No.
No, you do not. Is it possible that a competing firm had two new clients come in? Reuven Goldberg with an interesting tax matter and another client facing criminal tax indictment? Sure, it's possible. On the other hand, you encountered both of these pieces of information roughly simultaneously, and your assessment is that it's plausible that Reuven's the man in question here. You suspect that Reuven Goldberg might be facing criminal tax charges. Many members of your shul know Reuven well and face the following two questions. Stephen, a colleague of your shul, asks you if you know anything about Reuven, as Reuven asked Steve to lend him $50,000 for 30 days. I get this all the time. Congregants would come to me and say, I'm thinking about going into business with Harry. Do you know anything about Harry? What they really mean is, do I know anything nefarious about Harry? That's what they really want to find out. They don't want to find out if, you know, Harry has nice children or is a Zeus man. They want to find out, have I heard anything nefarious? So, congregant Stephen comes to you and says, Reuven asked me for a personal loan. There's something I should know about Reuven. Want to answer that question? You're the shul rabbi? Everybody I find likes to play rabbi until the questions get hard. That's what I've discovered in my shul rabbi, which is all of my congregants think they can do as good a job as they at the Haftorah of Shabbat Shuvah. But when it comes to hard problems, they say, my God. Tell me, you're the rabbi here. You know these two pieces of information. Steve has come to you and said, should I lend Reuven $50,000? And you know A and B, which is you know from your other job that the firm next to you got a large criminal matter and it's rare for them, and Reuven's a new client to the firm. What do you tell Steve? Anybody help me? Don Lacoste. Which, and so what do you say? Do you dial the cost by telling Steve everything? Steve, I'm going to tell you to be dial the cost, which is as follows. Here's what I know. Now, I told you all this information. You, Steve, should be dial moving the cost. Or should I be dial the cost by saying nothing? There's two ways to be dial the cost.
Well, it's always to say, I have individual information which requires investigation. I can't tell you for sure you should do it, but you should be careful because if there is, if there's a possibility, then you know you might lose a lot of money.
Okay, so one answer is the disclosure answer. Did I turn to Steve and say, yes, I have information. I don't know if it's true or not, or if it's complete or not, and it might be totally and completely false, because this information could be totally and completely false. Ruben could have gone to this firm for tax advice from his buyout of Donald Trump's tower, and Harry could have gone facing tax indictment. And I hand this information to Steve. What does Steve do next? What does Steve do next?
He
can't check. Steve cannot check. Because I haven't given Steve enough information to realistically check up on anything. Steve says, thank you, Rabbi. I very much appreciate the partial information you've given me, and I'm out of here. Just like when you say information to your congregants, which is you say, I can't share with you what's going on, but be careful. So my congregants understand from that formulation of I can't tell you what's going on, be careful. What do they understand that means?
That means
run for the hill. Get out of the boat and run for the hills right now as fast as you can. Your partial information is extremely damaging because it says to Ruben a repeatable piece of information. When it says to Steve a repeatable piece of information, Harry goes to Steve and says, Steve, Ruben approached me. Did he approach you? And you know what Steve summarizes your conversation, you the rabbi's conversation with him as? The rabbi said, stay away. That's the summary of the conversation you just had with Steve. So if you say to Steve, I don't have enough information, but there could be a problem, that's not the information that's at all useful. You have your hand up, I'm so sorry.
I'm a rabbi. She comes to me for an answer. I can't give an answer to him again. Just by telling him, I can't talk to you about it, that's an answer to him again. I can tell him, run like the wind. I cannot tell him anything. I'm just telling you, keep away from the shidduch, don't leave him alone, period. And that's an answer to him. Otherwise, it's an answer to him again.
Ah, now the answer goes as follows. I have another duty. The duty I have here is not only the ancient independent is sort of the abuzrayo of the Lashon Hara, which is since I know there's a shadow here.
And I've been approached,
I have no choice but to relay to the person the fact that there's a problem here. On the other hand, here's the real dilemma. It might turn out that what?
There are two people.
Well, no, maybe I have a better option. Maybe the better option is I have to turn to Ruben first and say, Ruben, here's the information I encountered. Can you give me an explanation? Will Ruben be believed there? You think the rabbi should pick up the phone and say, hey, Ruben? I'm a part-time lawyer at a firm. I heard something. Do you have anything you want to tell me? And see what Ruben says, because it would make my life much easier if Ruben confirmed it. Or should I go back to the two attorneys that I heard the rumor from and say, look, you told me about Ruben, and you told me about criminal tax fraud. I need you to tell me, is Ruben the criminal tax fraud officer? The correct answer, however, is the lawyers will never tell me.
Go to Ruben. You've got to go to Ruben. Ruben's got to be able to defend himself.
I've got to go to Ruben, and here's my problem in the real world as well. Will Ruben be honest with me? Ruben assures me, Rabbi, I have no idea what you're talking about. I am not facing any tax fraud indictment. I went to this firm because I'm selling my penthouse in Trump Plaza, and there's a tax consequence.
But that's a separate issue.
No, but if at the end of the day, Ruben isn't believed, no matter what he tells me, then I don't have to go there.
That's a new issue.
That's correct. That's the biggest problem. If I go to Ruben, I create a Mahila's problem through and through, a tail bearing back to the principle. I have no good way to solve this problem.
Yes, if you want to get you want $50,000
right, so if Steve turns to me, I say to Steve,
Steve, I'm sorry, I don't have anything to tell you. So if Steve, if he's smart, says to me, Rabbi, would you lend him the $50,000? You have to figure out how you want to answer that question as well. Both of these questions so far focus on how confident am I of the correctness of my plan. I just want to know your suggestion at first glance. Let me pick up the phone and call Ruben, which sounds very appealing, is in fact not a helpful suggestion at all. Because if the allegation against Ruben is true, Ms. Summer will lie. Meaning, if Ruben is really facing indictment, when I ask him, hey Ruben, are you facing indictment, he'll say no. Because criminals not only commit crimes, you know what they do? They lie about it. So if in fact Ruben's denial is meaningless, because Ruben will lie about it, it doesn't do any good to call Ruben up. Calling him up adds nothing to the problem, and it opens up a huge can of worms of further gossip, what they call recidivism, which is going back to a person and recounting to a person, I heard a piece of information about you, and churning the rumor mill even further. Let's go on to the next case. The next case is even more removed. Rachel asked you about setting up Ruben's daughter with her son. She asked the rabbi a more generic question. Anything I need to be aware of. Now, this is even more removed. How come?
The girl or the guy are not the people who are the principals. So.
Because at the end of the day, you don't marry your in-laws.
Not true.
Okay? At the end of the day, you don't marry your in-laws. I have a new role in life, which is my son is learning why he just got married. So I spent Rosh Hashanah with my daughter-in-law. It's very good. It's a wonderful relationship. No, I don't think you do not marry your in-laws. On the other hand, your in-laws are your in-laws. They're, what is the joke? They say the difference between in-laws and outlaws, or that outlaws are wanted. think about it. Very complicated statement. But it's hard to figure out. On the other hand, the relationship with Reuven's daughter to Rachel's son is much more distant. Maybe the fact that Reuven might be facing tax indictment isn't so. Well, I wouldn't say it has nothing to do with it, but it seems less directly connected than the question of whether I should lend Reuven $50,000. Presumably, if I demand Ruben $50,000 and he's indicted, I'm not going to get my money back. That seems extremely relevant in making a loan. Maybe it's less connected to the Shidduch system than to the financial system. But again, what you have here lurking in the background is an incredibly besmirching piece of information about Ruben that simultaneously is extremely relevant and could be totally false. This piece of information could have not a drop of truth to it. It could be that the law firm next to mine got two clients today. Reuven Goldberg and Harry the guy. And I just have made a leap of faith that's without any foundation at all in the reality of our time. And this is a very complicated balance to try to figure out how to handle the situation. Again, if you think the Chafetz Chaim's test is correct, that the only time you can reveal information is when it is vadai, then it is clear as day that you know what this case is not? Vadai. This is far from certain. On the other hand, if you think that Rabbi Moser is correct, or you think that Sitz Eliezer is correct, that defensive activity is permissible, maybe I would say to Steve as follows. Of course you should lend him the money, but it's always good to get collateral. Lend him the money, but get some collateral from him. That's defensive advice, because the presence of the getting collateral reduces the risk of the loan without, in fact, totally denying the loan. So this is a hard balance. In the sense of, I have to discount the possibility that the information is absolutely, totally, and completely false, with the fact that if the information is true, it's very harmful.
minimum of the posting, the people who I did shimush with on these issues, is not to follow the Chafetz Chaim, not to require vadai, but to require a standard less than vadai, like the Chaim Moser says, which is something like more likely than not. But even this requires a great deal of common sense, and it's not like facts get clearly labeled. People don't hand you a piece of information. You say, this piece of information is 53% likely. You have to have a modicum of common sense to help figure this out. A factor might be, are they a 6-person firm or a 600-person firm? How likely is it that they got 2 clients? Absolutely. That kind of information I can get a handle on. But even if they're only a 6-person firm, sometimes even 6-person firms get 2 clients on one day. It's more likely that Scadden Arts gets 2 clients in one day than a small firm. But even a small firm sometimes has good days with 2 good clients walking in. All I have here at some level is a coincidence. It's all I have here at some level is a coincidence. I have to acknowledge the possibility that this information is wrong.
You mentioned the American conversation, the subject that you know makes it, which is Tamar and the partial creation of all the value from my book.
Right?
It's included 40 minutes in the book that I said, I think it's better just give one and see that you can test the same thing they've done the partial creation. In terms of that, you see, the mother in terms of toughness, I have a the roughest men give most common sign in chest patterns that it's better just put the hand on fire to embarrass something publicly. You also find this in the end of the Gemara and Sanhedrin and the follow. So I wonder if this is the measure of parameter of assessment of the Prophet's time, how critical it is in maintaining the confidentiality in terms of the design of the Gemara and Sanhedrin. The whole document says you have to know this is a marriage.
So at the end of the day, you have to deal with the fact that the central sukkah here criticizes the Dalai Lama. Meaning, this is the refined Moses point, although you can point to many peripheral sukkahs. The central sukkah here is the sukkah here in Nida, which sounds like it's talking not in the Nagadic sense, but in the Halakha Lamaisa sense. And in the Halakha Lamaisa sense of the Gemara in Nida, the Gemara Nida says, make us regard. So, Rabbi Moser's response is that all these other sukkahs sound like they're much more agadic. The Gemara Nida that I reproduced for years is actually codified by the postman. Since it's actually codified by the postman, Rabbi Moser thinks it's more important. It's 10:29 and I have to run to Shane Paul. So, thank you very much. Have a wonderful day. So, see you.